of Shop of Maniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about front-end web design, development, everything like that. With me is Chris Coyer. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how you doing? We actually have another special guest, longtime friend of the show, friend in real life, Andy Bell. How you doing, Andy?
Good to have you on.
Yeah, good to have you here again. It's good.
Yeah, funny. It's just it's fun to watch Andy's story evolve. You got into studio work and client work, who knows, a long time ago now, but run a studio called Set Studio, literally set.studio. Killer URL. Can't forget it.
Killer price tag.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I heard the fonts weren't cheap either.
Is it one of those domains where it's like $9 the first year and $199 the next year?
Yeah, I have to remortgage every year to renew it. Yeah.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
Oh, wow. We have to make a little case internally for Pen.new every year because I feel like we have all kinds of dumb expenses at CodePen, but it's my pet one, you know? Like, I like that URL and I see it enough because I'm like, you know, I'm a little more, I'm a man of the community, you know?
But I use like all the time, Chris.
There you go. Yeah. I'm going to cut out that clip. It's just for you. I'm like, I will put this on my personal credit card if I have to. But we are keeping
it. I almost don't know how to make a pen beyond pen.new now that I've learned pen.new.
Now my sound bite's longer now.
Yeah. Even your spreadsheet, sheets.new, you know, like it's they're so useful, those domains.
We had some people on the Discord like brainstorming what else we could do with it. And I was like, you need to simmer down because we're not the fastest at shipping. But it was like pen.new/ and then like any string. And they're like, if you're logged in, it will fuzzy search your pens to find the closest matching pen and make a template from that to use, you know, so you could just be like, you know, pen.new/D3 and it would find like your best D3 pen and then start the new pen from that. Oh. Actually, it's like an amazing idea, but.
Kind of like mdn.io/whatever MDN thing you're looking for.
Are you blowing minds right now, Dave?
Oh, no, have you not used that? Yeah, you go mdn.io/whatever observer or what's the one I don't remember? Intersection observer. And it'll take you straight to the docs.
Looks like it does a hop on DuckDuckGo too. So DuckDuckGo must have some kind of I'm feeling lucky thing. It just plucks the first result off.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. What a clever idea. It means they didn't even have to do any work.
Yeah. The one time a year I use client bound in rec because I can't remember how to write it. I can use it for that then.
Yeah. Is it window? Yeah. Is it element? You don't know until you search for it.
I always liked, what is it? Insert adjacent HTML is a good, I really like that API, but it has like, there's like 9 things, you know, it's insert, is it before, end, after, begin, what, you know, like pre-pend. They're named well. I just, there's too many of them to remember.
Mm.
All right. Well, we got Andy on. We should talk about the internet or something. Well, I mentioned Set Studio. Let's look at it. Oh, you YouTuber people, listeners, are really going to have a treat here because you're going to see something that isn't just Dave and I's faces for the first time ever, maybe.
What?
But of course, we'll make this audio friendly as well somehow.
Live alt text. Let's go.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. Yeah,
I am. That's hilarious. GPT. I will describe the website. There is a cat licking its hand. There's not. There's not a cat licking its hand. That was GPT joke.
Look at it. Let's say, Dave. What do you think? What this font is, and what did it cost?
Well, I feel like it's I feel like it's like a Atkins grotesque or something.
Ooh, God, you're good at this.
Is gonna cost me $2.99 in the web font store, you know.
Yeah.
I bet you wish it was variable, but it isn't, you know. Mm.
Yeah. We have a real problem with fonts in Set Studio where we just buy really expensive ones all the time, but it just makes a difference, yeah. Haffer, XF, XH even.
Mm-hmm. Haffer, is it, for the people listening at home? 3 families.
Haffer, yeah.
That's a good-looking font.
Oh, it is variable. Oh, my gosh.
It is variable, yeah.
Oh, that's nice. I've never seen this before.
That's a good 3. That's a good. Got a good 3 in there.
Let's see what I do here.
Character. I need
Save forever.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't realize you could do that in Arc. Use the old.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, I could put it up, I put it up here, but I like the little the key command better. Notion Web Clipper is what I just used there.
People. Yeah, I use that for the newsletter. Yes.
Yeah, ooh, complete collection. Dave wasn't too far off, but if you just got the really black one, I guess it's a little cheaper, you know?
Yeah. Still. But then you got to get web and desktop as well, you know, and that's how they get you.
Do they get you on page views or something too? They probably do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Always. That really ranks things up.
Not needed. That's good.
I don't want to mess things up too much here, but yeah, Chris, you ahead. Are kind of showing like admin URLs for Covenant.
Oh, I don't care. What do you want to see?
Yeah. No. Okay.
Yeah. Just look at here's me playing with Bolt too. Oh my God. Is he stealing technology from Bolt? No, I'm using Bolt because it's super cool. Okay. You used it. It's
inspect
amazing.
Element copy paste. Yeah. Yeah.
Wanted to make sure we weren't leaking secrets that's going around.
What is it though? Yeah, we use GraphQL. You like that?
Yeah.
You have a lot of staging environment.
Dev server. Interesting. Interesting.
Yes. And I rename my tabs in Arc because renaming your tabs is an excellent feature that all browsers should offer.
What keeps me on it? Yeah. Mm. Tried all the others and can't be renamed those tabs.
Ooh, do you see that animation? My gosh.
So set, y'all are, I feel like, a very high-end design, but also like your whole thing, I feel like, is designing with the browser instead of like shoehorning your design into the browser. So, and you always come up with these really, you know, just sort of, for lack of a better term, native looking designs, right? Like designs that just kind of look and feel good on the web. Is that like, is that just you, or is that your whole team that knows this process, or how's that work?
Successfully fully radicalized everyone in the agency to be obsessed with, you know, fluid scales and, you know, layouts that work. Just you give it some hints and you say, look, I want you to do this, but if you can't do that, you know, here's your bounds, you know, like the whole every layout thing. And like, we're all completely and utterly obsessed with that. And it means like the stuff we build like works with the browser rather than like you said, Dave, like fighting the browser. Like, been there, done that, built some real shit UIs with that. Sorry, Chris Enns, you might have to mute that one. But the whole like premise like of that flexible layout systems and stuff, it comes from pure trauma, right? And sure, CSS is super powerful now, but nothing's as powerful as letting the browser do its thing. So works well, and you can make things look nice while you're doing that too. Like, it's not really a trade-off. But yeah, we don't deliver like Figma comps, we deliver front ends. So
there's no, you like, do they know that? I'm sure they do, but it is funny to, I wonder if that's an expectation. I've never really done client work, so I don't know. But is there like, where's our Figma?
Sort of, like, so we've been trying new ways of doing things for the last couple of years, and what we've settled on is we don't send clients Figmas anymore. We, like, no design goes out to a client. So we obviously do creative in Figma, but none of that goes to the client. Like, it goes in looms, and everything has to be sort of with an explanation. And because ultimately what we're trying to do is maintain control of the project at all times, right? So we're never asking permission. We do a long discovery process. So like, we know what we're doing and we know what we want to do. So it's more like, this is the direction we're going, unless fundamentally you disagree with what we're doing. And it works really well for that. And then, yeah, the only time they're physically like a tangible assets, it's in a browser. And the design changes a lot in the browser too, because things feel like a good idea in Figma. And then you get it in the browser and, you know, it doesn't feel so good anymore. Like, for example, on this set site, that reel of client stuff, that was going to be a bento grid originally. So our original creative had that, but then it just didn't feel good in the browser, and we couldn't do it without writing like a really specific layout. And I was like, well, let's think of something different then, because we don't want this, you know, everything else like snapping and naturally, and then suddenly this layout's just going oop at breakpoints. So a lot of stuff happens in the browser, and creative too. So like prototyping and stuff, to get it to where we are now.
There's stuff like you just can't do this in Figma. You could just like make a note and says this thing should be positioned sticky, but like that's not very satisfying. I feel like nobody uses position sticky like that specifically is so nice.
Yeah.
And it's so web specific that it feels like you're, you know, whatever, eating your own cereal or
you could do a weak impression of it in Figma, but like our attitude of Figma is like it's just a picture of our website.
Or scroll, you know? Snapping like yeah. this. Well, how are you gonna do that in Figma?
Yeah, you just without, you know, spending hours prototype, like you just communicate with each other instead and be like, yeah, let's make this snap. And we'll do it.
I feel like it would be hard to get into a position where you have a horizontal scroll, like, you know, in a Figma where you're like, okay, I'm got this column and I'm filling it out. And then this is just going to shoot off. And then I'm going to draw a little scroll bar because that's cool. You know, like no one would, you know, but like in the browser, you're like, dude, this should probably just be a scroll bar. Okay, done. You know, and like the decision tree makes itself sort of, I don't know. Like, yeah.
We're lucky that like we've, you know, there's four of us and like Jason, who like leads our creative, like he's super clued into the web, you know, he writes pretty good CSS. And so like he comes at things like really creatively, but also like web first, you know, like it's always in his mind. And then obviously the rest of us are super web first as well. So it really does need that to do like what we're doing. I think if we brought another creative designer in, we'd have to sort of train them up on the web first so they really understand what are the bounds of the web and what can it do, which is loads. So we're not really limited now like we used to be in the bad old days.
So Seth Studio's the studio and Piccalilli is an educational arm that it looks like you kind of tied them together.
Linked them up. Yeah, so like I guess from a business perspective, Set Studios the company and Piccolo is part of that company. But yeah, this thing.
So what's Piccolo?
I guess it's a tech publisher now. It started off as my little blog years ago and now it's sort of evolved. We made that conscious decision last year to de-andify the Piccalilli site as much as possible and, you know, full brand
operation de-andify.
Get this guy off of here. Yeah, and it was like, yeah, huge branding job and a huge redesign and replatforming. Like we did the whole kit and caboodle on it. And now
Astro, clearly.
It's built with Astro now. It was on 11T before. We needed Astro because, you know, we do the courses on there. So we need that sort of server side stuff for that sort of business.
Like auth and then, stuff?
Yeah, it's got all the auth system in there, payments, the whole shebang. And then, so we needed that system. So we had a choice really. It was like, do we do it with like Next.js or Astro? And like, I don't want a gigabyte of JavaScript going down the pipe. So it was Astro all the way. And we're really happy with that decision. Yeah, it's a really easy to maintain code base now. There you are, Chris. It was a huge job, but like now we're cooking, and we can do all sorts of
things. Yeah, and so you're on like the same URL that serves like a blog post or whatever is the same URL that you log into and watch your course on and everything. Yeah, okay.
It's all under one roof, but the whole thing's themeable, right? So like that look and feel that we're looking at now with like the serifs and the big old nice headings, that's all custom property controlled. So nearly every property is looking for one property and then it's falling back to another. So the idea is, so we're doing like two courses this year for other authors we can implement like a custom brand for that course across the whole board for them. And it's still all on the same infrastructure.
Which means different type, different colors,
everything you can see, you can change. Yeah. Which is going to be really useful because, you know, like one of them is going to be a video course. So we can sort of pair back the UI for that one. And then the other is a written course. So it'll probably inherit quite a lot of what's already there, but you can change everything on there. Right now, the only thing that's using that system is dark mode, but like the whole system's ready to be overridden. Yeah.
Yeah. It looks like it'd be probably pretty satisfying to use. You did a lot of work here to get all these kind of things ready. It's interesting the double fallback thing too, that you made that kind of a,
hey guys,
that's always how you work. Like it has a specific name, but then, you know, you can set it or not. Right, because it's happy to fall back to something that definitely will be set.
Yeah, it's like the whole semantic design token thing, right? You got your core design tokens, and like, you know, color dark, color primary, and then the semantic design tokens, like, you know, button background or button color, and that's what the theme changes, is the semantic design tokens, and then so like almost everything is looking for them. There's a few points where like we're doing direct design token onto the element, but very, very few. And with that methodology in place. Yeah,
it probably takes some discipline to do that. Like I'm not even going to set this, but I'm going to put it there because we do it for everything else too. And then if somebody wants to override it, they can.
Yeah, it's a slower build for sure. But then you've got to think of like, we're always looking like well further down the road than we need to look. When we're doing these things, so we work in these smaller iterations, but like we knew what was coming down the line, you know, we knew we were going to do my course last year, but then we knew, well, that's just laying the cow path for future courses for other authors, and so we knew we'd want to implement branding, so it was like, well, we're just gonna have to build the whole thing to be customizable, and then when we come to do that stuff, we'll be patting ourselves on the back. They were not having to write like course name.css and like hacking loads of overly specific CSS in there. Like we can change a few custom props and bish bash, off we go.
Yeah, that's nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little more sane override system. Fair enough.
Yeah. Means if we redesign the site as well in the future, which I hope we don't, because god damn it, it was a lot of work. But it'd be a case of changing custom properties. Like that was the whole idea. Like, give the platform as much health as possible up front. Because the old Piccadilly site was just the worst code base ever because I wrote it. So it was it was a side project, right? So I just used to like crap a load of CSS in there and then move on to something else. And so it was real ugly by the end. So that was that decision to re-platform. It was like, we need a clean break. If we want to evolve this thing and grow it, we need a clean break, and then we've got a good foundation to work from them. And it's paid off big time.
That's nice. Mm-hmm. It almost makes me feel like that is so much heavy lifting that you could do like almost the easier thing and layer it down too. Like you already have this, and then you can just wrap a layer around each component and be like, it's a component dot header too. And then it's like soup, you know, whatever that is, like ultra low specificity. I guess it's not even specificity with layers, right? It's like literally a different layer, and then
cascade thing in it.
Yeah. Then it's like the easiest thing in the world to override. Interesting.
I mean, the beauty of the custom property setup is flat, isn't it? So it's completely flat. And because none of them are defined a lot of the time, it's like, As soon as you define one of them, no matter where you are in the cascade, it's going to be like, oh yeah, I know that now, and work. Yeah.
That's so cool.
So, yeah.
Was it weird, like, opening up your project, like your thing to like other people? Was that, or what, did you have to like break up with it a bit, or?
I had to learn a lot, Dave. And I had to learn a lot of like how not to be a control freak over the last few years. Like, both with the studio and the Piccadilly, you know, like the studio evolved from my freelance business and then turned into an agency. And then Piccadilly evolved from my blog to publisher. And yeah, letting go of it is real hard. But then like everyone at Set Studio is better than me. So like on that front, it's easy, you know, like I want this done properly. Okay, I'll get Leanne to cut it because she's good.
And Jess is good at design. I deal with the customers.
Yeah, that's it. I just, exactly that, Chris. Yeah. I just deal. I'm on the front line. Well, no, we've got someone else on the front line. I've got Vicky on the front line. I'm on second on the front line. So
yeah, nice.
The rule is now is if you speak to me in a project, you're in trouble. for clients, yeah. Works well. Yeah,
that's nice. You're bad cop in the
yeah, very client, bad cop. Yeah.
Yeah. Client agency relationship. I think everyone, you need that, man. You need mm-hmm. somebody who.
Well, you know all too well, don't you, Dave? Yeah, uh-huh. You need some bad cop in the agency.
Yeah. You need a decision maker on the client side, like somebody who has ultimate power.
Yeah.
And you need access to them. Not, they can't be like five chains away, you know?
Yeah.
But then you need somebody who also, on the agency side, who is like not afraid to be the bad guy in certain situations. So
we've got a nice balance because we've got Vicky and she's nice, like really nice. And then you've mm-hmm. got me who's not so nice. But like the
you're just British. It's not. don't talk yourself down. It's cultural.
It's just sweet, yeah. Yeah, if you need something, if something needs to move, then you deploy me like an attack dog. But then it's like, oh, like the client needs a belly tickle. Go on, you go and talk to him, Vic, and it works really well when you were like that. But yeah, they definitely need a bit of fear in them. Well, they just take the mic and ruin the project, right? If you let the client do exactly what they initially thought they wanted to do, you're going to get a bad website. Because you know, like you're the pros, not them. So you've got to get that relationship like from day one, you know, and then it works really well. If they give you control, then you get a good website at the end. If you end up being human paintbrushes, you get bad website. And I've been doing this over 15 years and that rule's never changed, right? So it's that old meme, isn't there? Yeah, you know, we build it, or that you watch us build it, and the price goes up, and then yeah,
if you want to help, it's even more expensive. Yeah.
Nothing worse. Yeah, oh, we've got an internal team. That's cool. Yeah, all right, we'll hand over at the end then.
Yeah, it's just tripled the price. Beautiful. I think it was, you know, we always had a saying, "Let the Wookiee win," at Paravel, and you know, it's from that scene in Star Wars where Han Solo or, you know, Luke is playing Chewie and whatever hologram chess. And he's just like, "Hey kid, let the Wookiee win," you know, or whatever. And we just kind of glommed onto that because, you know, sometimes the organization or there's a person who's just won't change their mind. And, you know, like you can spend 9 months battling that person or let them make the decision and then you have to fix it later when it nosedives or what, you know.
That's where the decision log comes in, Dev. Like a read-only table. Oh my god,
tell me about this.
So we only roll it out for like reasonably problematic clients. Obviously, we don't tell them the problematic. We just suddenly decision log will appear. They'll be like listening and going, "Wait a minute, we had a decision log.
We had a decision log. We loved it."
It depends. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean the client's an arsehole. It, a lot of the time, it's like you say, Dave, where there's lots of decision makers in the team, right? And they're on the organization team, and they're not very good at communicating with each other. So the decision log is only we can edit it in the studio. And every time a decision made is you make a log of it. Who made the decision, what the decision is, any details of it, what time, what date.
Oh.
And then when that inevitably changes, it gives you grounds to be able to say, well, we're going to have to send you another SOW because, you know, you made this decision back in April 2024 and now you're going against your own decision that's now been logged, so we need to increase the budget. Nothing scares people more than seeing their name on a ratified list as well. And it tends to make them behave more and it tends to make them think more as well before they decide on things. So it's very subtle, but yeah, if you're working in client services, and it's a pro tip, I might have to blog about it one day because it works. It works really, really well.
Yeah, it's kind of cool, especially seems like it would. Accountability and everybody has access to the document or whatever. Our little like micro version of it at CodePen is there's always like a you know, there tends to be like bulleted lists of stuff and tickets and notes and meeting notes and stuff. And if it's phrased like a question or something, often somebody will like hit return tab, which just like tabs in a bullet. And then it's like square bracket, capital answer or decision square bracket. And then it says what the answer is. And what's nice is that because it's Notion, which is, I know we're all very 50-50 on lately for various reasons. It will be in the change log, so it will show you who changed it and when and all that. So you don't necessarily need to like hand type out the date or anything. But I do find that pretty useful. Not to point at somebody's face, but almost to come back to and be like, that was decided. So that's how we're going to do it, because it says so right here in this document.
Yeah. Like, unless you have a brilliant argument to overturn this decision,
which is also fine,
which is I'm into if there's a better thing, like, but it needs to be like everyone's looking at it saying that is better, like, you mm-hmm. know, like, yeah, I had that situation recently. I like this decision log thing. We've been talking on the show a lot about like having a why column in the database, you know, just like, why do you do this, you know, or why does yeah. this post exist?
It works, and even less good for deleting rows, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Why do we delete this row? Well, it doesn't exist anymore. I have like, I'm setting up an Obsidian, I think, like I told y'all, and then kind of starting to port all my Notion junk to.
So what even is it? Like, I think of it as just like a folder full of Markdown files with some extra UI on it. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
That's how I use it. Yeah. I don't really do much of the extension stuff. It's just a lot of Markdowns. Yeah.
This sort of like, I don't know. What would you be calling it? It's sort of like a hypertext feature where anything can link to anything. That's like not new to us. But this idea of like, you know, this on this site, it says writing is telepathy. And anytime you say telepathy, you can link that to a tag. And then now you click that tag, and then that now you're in your, you can view any post or anything you've ever written that has also has the tag telepathy. So it's kind of like a
did hypertext it does that in click like for the, you? Do you have to put a little tag thingy before it?
I don't, but you know, if you're linking documents or like, you know, it's sort of, I'm not there yet because I'm really kind of just getting into it. But you know, stuff like I do prototypes, right? I talk a lot about that. I collect a lot of links about it. I read a lot of books about it. I, you know, like if I could just kind of dump all this stuff, and then like anytime I'm thinking about prototyping, I'm like, click a link, and now I have everything I've ever thought about prototyping in one big bucket. Yeah, that's kind of cool.
Assuming you write down your thoughts like that, I feel like I don't have that many like private notes. I like write and then
Well, and that's just it. It's like I went through all my private notes, and I, for a lot of them, I'm like, why does this exist? So I made a little why call out in each of these posts. Like, why did I make this? You know, and it's like, oh, okay, yeah. Now I remember.
That's a good idea. Oh, you did it. I love that.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, Obsidian. Yeah.
Okay, are you all in? Are you like Obsidian's the way to go for me for this stuff?
I'm not. Andy has been on it longer, but one thing I don't like, I'll give you a like and a don't like. I don't like the editing experience. It's this weird Markdown plus scripting, and then like you'll open a document, and sometimes it's in like the reader mode where you're like reading a preview, like a Markdown file, you know,
which
like
means
a rendered
you can't
Markdown.
Edit it.
You can't edit it. So then you edit it. But then sometimes you're in this mode where it looks like Markdown, but you click on like a live preview and you click on things, and now you're editing it, and now it looks like Markdown. And that's finicky to me. Like my biggest challenge right now. Other than that, and the UI is just a little bring your own. But it is fully themable with CSS and all this stuff and lots of amazing themes and all that. I think what's cool about it is sort of just, you know, it's a folder full of Markdown files. You're never going to beat that. Like
on your computer too, right? Yes.
On my computer, but I pay $4, $4 American to sync it to the cloud, where Notion was like actually raising the cost on me from like $8 to $12. So I have parlayed that cost and 50% cost increase to a 50% cost savings. So
I see. And that's otherwise, what, how do you, I'm looking at the homepage and they have a Mac app and an iOS app here. Does it, is that, is $4 the only way those two things are going to coexist nicely? Or could you just throw them in a Dropbox or something?
I do with iCloud. So I used to do the same thing that Dev is using. But I found it's not that good at keeping things in track. It's the same with iCloud as well. I think it's the thing that sort of frustrates me about Obsidian. Like, I've got a rule of thumb with Obsidian. It's Obsidian for me and Notion for thee. Like, anything that requires any level of collaboration is Notion, straight up. You know, like, okay. Everything that we do is in Notion in the studio. But, like, for me, like, article ideas and just lists, I write a lot of lists, or, like, any ideas that I'm sort of forming. But I also do stuff like the gym. Like, I keep a track of, like, what weights I've got for particular bits and pieces, and the network gets a bit spotty in there, so like it won't sync properly sometimes, and then so it's cool. I like the concept. I like the fact that I own all my stuff, you know, like that's a big deal for me. My trust levels in Notion have sort of degraded somewhat over the last few years. I mean, you know, Chris, I'm a super fan of Notion and have been for a long time, but it's definitely degraded weirdly ever since they started introducing AI. Who would have thunk it? But it's, I don't know. Like, obviously, there's just no other option for us in terms of, like, the projects we do. But I could never use Obsidian for anything other than what I use it for, to be honest. I've similar frustrations that Dev has with, like, the editing experience. I know there's that weird... that weird view that's like editable preview, but it feels a lot like a WYSIWYG editor from an old CMS to me. And
yeah,
I just like writing Markdown. So
I will say, too, a lot of the functionality is brought in through plugins, like both first party and community. But what's weird is under the hood, it's all just YAML front matter to run these plugins, basically. But what is, I think, the like there's thousands of 2300 different plugins, but you sort of get a smell of like WordPress plugin vibes, like everyone did it different, so here we go, you know, like this plugin's view is going to look different than this plugin's view. My only critique there would be, it'd be cool if the Obsidian design system gave a few more primitives for plugin developers to hook into. But
it's one thing I can't believe Notion never did. Like, they've got this whole system, and I can't believe they're never like, oh, by the way, you can create an extension for Notion. Like, I can't believe they never did that.
I don't know. Now, seeing this, it does seem like, oh, geez, yeah. Clearly. Mm. But part of that, I mean, I would think part of some of that excess is just how opinionated Notion is, that like there can't be a bad looking Notion document because they've limited it so far. And there can't be, you can't open a Notion document. I mean, I guess you can open one that you can't edit, but if you know, I don't know if I've ever done that because I only just use it for my own crafts. Like, if you can see it, you can edit it.
Mm-hmm. And Notion's good, like, for client stuff and just like us in general. Like, it's never going to be like Jira, right? Or other project management tool name, but like, it gets you far enough. And the fact that, like, oh, I've recorded a quick loom, I'm just going to paste it and boop, it's embedded. And I'm going to paste the link to Figma, boop, it's embedded. And it's like, everything just works like naturally. And there's like very little friction. And clients pick it up so quick as well, a lot of the time. You know, if you give them some sort of guidelines on stuff, and yeah, it works good. I hope it gets a bit faster. It's gone slow again recently.
I'm not going to say. Can't comment. Don't want to We all know the problem. We're just not saying it.
Yeah, I'll say it, Dave. It's the AI bit. Yeah.
Yeah, that little guy. It's like Clippy.
You can turn him off, by the way. Yeah.
I call him Churny because he's like actively driving churn.
I've got another name for him, but I can't say it on a podcast. I emailed support and I was like, just turn it off, man. Like, I don't want it. I don't want it. And they did. So it worked. Yeah.
Well, that was kind of my, like, there's just no way to stop it. You know, they're all, you know, it's like, it's every block you start is like, use AI, you know, it's like, no, I don't. And then if I try to use AI, it's like, you're out of AI credits. It's like, yeah, I know. I tried it 10 times and I'm done. So Notion's been fun. Yeah, there's Churny. He's on the screen there. His little face.
Never though. Yeah.
At least it's not a what's a Sparkles? Is that the official icon of AI?
Oh yeah, Sparkles.
Yeah, I've heard some absurd up and down about it. I somehow don't hate it. I'm like, I don't know. But sometimes it's an icon becomes a thing. It's just, I don't know. I don't have a big problem with it. I keep looking at this word telepathy. This dude told me to listen to this. The telepathy tapes.
Oh, I'm almost done with the first season.
All right, you're almost done with it? Yeah. For me, it went from like, I was highly skeptical of it to, oh my God, telepathy is real. To at the end, I'm like, all right, I'm skeptical again.
Yeah. That it takes you on this arc and then they're like, oh, by the way, I guess for those who haven't listened to telepathy tapes, the premise is nonverbal people, like people with autism, also have the ability to communicate telepathically, you know?
Yeah, like all of them, according to this.
Like all of them, and they all meet on this hill where they also, like, you know, talk to each other, cross continents or what, you know.
Totally. You wake up, go to school, come home, lay on your bed, put a pillow on your head and just go hang out with your friends in the telepathic zone, the hill, which, Dave, would be a killer TV show, wouldn't it? Just call it cool. The hill.
Oh, yeah. That's
amazing.
That's cool. I think that's cool. And I guess there is a phenomenon where people are reporting this similar experience. And so, like, as all good podcasts, investigating a phenomenon, you know what I mean? And they like run tests on folks and stuff like that to see if they can read minds and stuff. Anyway, I'll let you listen to it, but I think where it starts breaking down for me is, you know, around the seventh episode, they're like, oh, they also like talk to God and are.
Oh, Dave, it's the same thing for me.
And it's do a telekinesis.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, they can move objects?
Oh, this is
like,
and there's angels and demons, and that's probably what some people think of aliens. And you're like, it just became this grab bag of paranormal stuff at the end. And you're like, what are you doing? You have a couple of people here who have 100% hit rate on telepathy stuff. Like, I'm going to write down a word and only I can see it. And they're just like, giraffe. They without failure, they can do it. You just did it. You proved telepathy. And then you're like, well, now let's go off the rails. You know, you're like, don't go off the rails. You've got it right here in your hand. Wait.
Yeah. I was a believer in episode 6, but episode 7.
Yeah. It doesn't get any
threw
better.
Me off the cliff. Yeah. So.
Oh, well. Telepathy has nothing to do with obsidian. Sorry for the detour there. I need to do it. So, what else are you excited about, Andy? Like, you got Piccalilli courses coming or just web stuff generally? You know, it's kind of an interesting time to run a publication about the web. A lot of stuff happening.
It's a lot of stuff to write about. I mean, I've been on a bit of a slump. So, I did that course last year. It's like 55 lessons.
Complete CSS available.
That's the one. Yeah. It was a slog. It was a huge course. But it was something that I'd had in my brain for a long time. You know, like, you can write good CSS and you can learn loads of syntax to do that. And I'm going to teach you that stuff. But also, like, I'm also going to teach you how to talk to each other and how to plan things properly and how to do all the work before you write CSS that means the CSS you write is really nice and simple. And it's like working with designers and taking a first creative concept and finding flaws in it and feeding that back. And And the end result is you still maintain the creative, but you get something that's actually like much better to build for the web. And so I really wanted to get that stuff down and out of my head. So sort of committed to doing that last year. But there was my course was a test bed for what we actually really want to do on Piccalilli, which is publish other people's courses. So we've got two coming this year. Got Matt Marquis, a friend of the...
Really?
Friend, oh, yeah, wizard friend in real staff life. Himself.
What is he going to do, though? It's a wild card. What is he going to do?
A Mega Man course. No, he's going to do a JavaScript course that we just decided on a name yesterday. JavaScript for everyone. Yeah.
Because he has that, a book apart rip. He had that kind of intro to JavaScript book there. I wonder if he could parlay that.
I really like how Matt writes about JavaScript. Yeah. He's so pragmatic about it. And like, that's what you need, right? If you want to learn a language, sort of that pragmatism. So that's going to be really good. So that'll be a mostly written course. But then we've got Scott Riley, designer, doing a design course called Mindful Design.
Wow.
So he's had a book for a couple of years, yeah.
Nice.
He's doing a video course. So like these two, obviously like really good friends of mine. So like first publish other people's courses is like, I need them to be people that I trust and people that trust us also, because like we're still finding a process that works, right? But we're trying not to make it too clinical also. It's like you publish in your own voice, you know, like you are you, because like both Matt and I can attest, like you write for a very large corporate doing a course, they have to do it in their voice, and that is hard, you know, like that is the hardest part. So it's like, no, you are you, so you write in your voice, you do whatever you need to do, and then like I'm going to come in and like edit them and support them through the production of the course, and then we provide all the infrastructure that goes with it and the marketing and everything else. So like it's a real nice setup, and then the hope is that we just keep doubling and doubling every year, and more courses, and like really try and build this thing up to hopefully help more people and build good stuff. But we've always got that underlying pragmatism. Like our whole deal with Piccalilli is like front end that you can apply to your day job, you know? So like whenever I talk to guest authors, it's like, if a user can read this and then be like, I can apply this to my job.
Yeah.
And I feel like I've learned something that's really tangible, then that's what we want to be publishing. Less so like, check out this cool feature that's coming in 2028. It's like, no, this stuff you can do like near enough now, you know? And I think that's it, we've created a lane for ourselves, I think, that works.
It's funny because it can be easier to write about the new stuff because it gets your own brain going really easy. It's harder to be like, you know, I don't know, let's look at some ways to use Float or whatever that, you know, like, I don't know, I've been... Float has been in my brain for 20 years and I don't know that I have a lot to say about it at the moment. Like maybe, but you know, it hasn't been for everyone. So there might be stuff there. Gosh, look at how nice underline.
Even like a that grid course or something would be tough, right? Like just like, grid, like, you know, but it's like what, 10% or something of sites use grid. Maybe it's 20. It's like chronically underused. And so
I always questioned that crap though, because it was like, oh, TypeScript's on or Flexbox is on 80% of the web and Grid's only on 20. And you're like, that's because WordPress ships with some Flexbox stuff for their columns. That's whether people use it or not is in every style sheet that WordPress ships. And that's why. So yeah. it doesn't reflect like people's typed stuff. It's almost like you need the private GitHub repos of sites shipped in the last year. Show me that.
Yep.
Mm. And then let's see. And it'll be 50-50 or whatever, you know?
Mm. Right. I've got an article going out tomorrow about grid versus flex, I guess.
Whoa, really? Nice. You're going to touch that?
You never guess, you never guess what the end product of that is. It's use what works. You know, if it works, it's right. I like to paraphrase Rich Landry a lot with that one, because like I think people look for absolutes. And basically, what I say in the article is, do you want complete control or perceived complete control? Then choose grid and choose media queries. Do you want the browser to do work for you? And do you want to sort of do composable algorithmic layouts? Then Flexbox is bloody good at that. Do you want to meet in the middle, which is where we are, like do a lot of the stuff with the Flexbox, and then where you really need the controls, then take grid and use grid. And that's exactly how we like built Piccalilli. Like the header on Piccalilli is just nuts. So it's like, we can't build that with Flexbox. So we built that with grid, and it's just like picking the right tool for the job. So like if it's two-dimensional layout, grid. If it's complicated,
you'll just get this feel for it eventually.
Exactly. It's muscle memory. Yeah.
I feel like the header is the classic Flexbox one. Cause you're like, there's chunks of stuff in a header. I have no idea what size those columns are going to be.
Push them away from each other.
Yeah. I need to control how they squish and push. That's Flexbox territory. But if you want an answer, the answer is grit, because it's better.
Yeah.
I don't know, not really, but yeah, it's of course both, but yeah, very interesting stuff. I can't wait to read the article. I'm sure you'll make salient points about the differences.
Well, I've certainly tried, but yeah, it's nice to I've been trying to work out recently, like, what can I even write about? I don't know, like other writers might struggle with this, like you do a big body of work and then it's like you feel like you have to then do big articles, you know, like big long complicated articles. I was like, no, actually my strength is more in shorter, snappier stuff, and then pay writers to write the big ones that, you know, they're full of like ideas and full of knowledge. And I tend to now just do the newsletter and like link posts and stuff, and then occasionally I'll drop in with an article, but like it feels good to do it like that, to be honest. And then when I do have a good idea, it's actually like it's worth writing about.
Very much the same. I prefer the one paragraph article.
Chris Coy special on CSS tricks back in the day. Yeah, it'd be a little bosh bang. And you're like, he did that straight in the WordPress era. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I got into the opposite habit where it's like, I think every article should be like a magnum opus of like 72 different ideas coming together, laying in all those lanes all at once. And it's been a challenge to be like, how about 3 to 5 paragraphs, Dave? Like maybe that's a cool way to blog, and they would actually go out in less than 5 years. And it's been a challenge. So
put yourself on a word count budget is my advice for people.
Yeah. Like,
yeah. Well, 1,000 words. Yeah. If it goes over
that in Obsidian, like they have like these little writing goals things, you know, and like, you can be like, there's a whole plugin for it, but it's like, you know, just like you set your word limit and then you just try to write it. And so, yeah, no, I kind of like, I think that's I sort of wondered, you know, it's that thing. It's like, A, what is the answer? Like, what's the perfect blog post length, right? Like, what is it? 1,000 words, let's say. And then, okay, now that I know that, B, do I even want to play that game? You know, where you're like trying to optimize content for whoever, you know, I swing heavy on that. So
my rule on it, well, it's not a rule, but it's like my sort of thinking about putting a budget on it is like, if I'm going over 1,000 words, like, am I being concise enough? And am I covering too much? Like, am I trying to explain too much? Like, is there a link I can link out to that'll explain this particular concept here? You know, and I'm a big fan of doing that because people are cleverer than me. So it's like, I found this article and it explains stuff really well. So go and read this if you don't understand what I'm talking about, and then come back. And it sort of keeps the levels going for everyone then. So if someone does know, they can scan through it. If someone doesn't know, they can use it like a navigation, I guess, to like learn things. Like, and he's like, okay, well, this is a recommended post, so I'm going to read it because obviously it's good. So that's how I see it. And I find myself explaining things less and less that are on the periphery of what I'm talking about. And then it's like, no, all the code samples are on this one little thing, you know, and that's, yeah, sort of helps. And it keeps, like, if I can't draft it in a morning, I can't publish it. I can't keep a draft like running for a long time. Like, it has to be drafted and then ready to edit within a few hours of like planning an outline for it. So,
oh man, yeah. You just need some cold, hard ADHD stamina. He's Fester for years.
Stack talking myself down. Yeah.
Because you can always expand in our, when it comes to tech, there's all these things that you have to make choices on. You're like, okay, when and where am I going to talk about browser compatibility? And it can be a publication level thing. Like at Piccalilli, you could just be like, oh, we're not going to do that in the body of the post. We're only going to put it at the bottom, say, in charts or something. I'm saying that's a theoretical choice you could make. Or you could be like, we're only going to use the baseline widgets and we're going to sprinkle them in wherever or something like that. But it's also tempting to be like, that can get in the way too. You know, every post is just, you know, types out a paragraph explaining as I write the browser support for this feature. But it's like, that can be nice too, because that means you can put it somewhere in the article that feels like a natural place to explain it. And sometimes that's useful, because sometimes features are progressive enhancement a bull. And if you didn't explain that with words, it could get lost if all you ever did was put a chart in. You know, it's always tricky stuff like that. And I mention that because it's talking about length. You know, it's hard to just be like, look at this new cool scope feature. That's too light usually, because it could be so little browser support that it kind of doesn't matter. So if you're trying to get somebody to read and care about your publication and you're not giving them important context, you're not doing a very good job as a publication.
Yeah. There's a lot of, the whole thing for me is like, I can't recommend something to someone unless I've battle tested it in the real world, right? So like some of the newer CSS stuff, like I imagine people think, I wish Piccalilli would publish more about like the latest, greatest feature. And we sort of do that with the links, like Adam Argyle posted about the CSS carousels the other day. It's like, yeah, go and check this out.
Oh my God, cool. Did you see that?
It's cool. Yeah, it's really cool. But it's
of the four features are totally theoretical.
Yeah, and it's so bleeding edge. And it's like, well, I can't, with all honesty, recommend anyone does that until like I've used it in a project, right? Or used it in a client project. So that's like one of the sort of guarantees you've got on Piccalilli is like anything that's written by us, especially like me or anyone in the team, like it's been tested, it's been battle tested, you know, like this approach, it's been used on a big project and it works, you know. And that's, I like to stay in that. I say right at the end of the course, in the last lesson, in the wrapping up, it's like, why haven't you done layers and why haven't you done scope and why, you know, and it's like, because we didn't need to. Like the way that we've architected the CSS, it just wasn't required. Like we've used the cascade, we've used specificity, we've done things in a really sort of sensible manner, and it's quite a simple page. Sure, like it's all about like finding the use for these things and then using them for that use. And I feel like people feel like they have to use every new thing that CSS comes up with. But CSS, so much stuff is coming now. You really don't. And that's it. And so I like to sort of report on that new stuff, I guess, but there'd be a long time before I'm writing an article on Piccalilli about using the carousel stuff in CSS, because I want to see that thing working in a real project, you know, not like a hypothetical demo. Yeah.
Like, oh, you could have wrote this as scope.
Yeah.
Carousel. Dude, don't you read new stuff?
I did a one about, about nesting recently, and it got some of the fellas upset. And it was like, yeah, this is the thing that I've been waiting for, so I don't have to use SAS anymore. And it's just like, well, okay, well, I've used nesting, you know, like I was all in on BEM years ago, and nesting was really useful in SAS in those days. But the code base gets pretty gnarly pretty quick, unless you set yourself some sort of like limits. Like if you're 5-6 level deep, you're in trouble, because the CSS that's getting generated from that is bad. And then with like native CSS nesting, there's specificity issues that can come with it, because it basically generates, is it a is or a not or something behind the scenes. So you're adding points where you don't want to add them, and So it's like, handle with care is basically what I'm saying with it. It's like, it's a cool feature for sure, but make sure you can understand your own code also when you come back to it in 6 months, which you won't, unless it's, use documentation, etc. But this carousel thing looks good. What I like about this carousel thing is what I mentioned in the link was they've actually built it with an accessibility team, is just so refreshing to see, like
novel web standard idea there. But
because we've had a few bad ones, haven't we?
A few false starts. Years.
Yeah, like the original detail summary was pretty yikes on that front.
Dialogue. Took about 10 or 8 years to fix.
And it reduces trust.
Mm-hmm.
Where this sort of thing is increasing trust again, I think. So that's good. I like it. I like the use of pseudo elements. I think it's nice.
I didn't realize it was as spec'd out as it was. I mean, they're just draft specs, but it's surprising to me. If you haven't seen this thing, it's like, it's not because you think of, a carousel, it'll use scroll snapping, Oh, neat. Yeah, totally does. So you can do that today. In fact, go to Set Studio and look, they're using a bunch of scroll snapping. It looks great. But everything else is like, what the heck is that? So there's this pseudo element called scroll button, which just plops a pseudo element on the page that when clicked scrolls the area exactly one page forward, depending on its width. I was like, that's not real. What the hell is that? But then apparently it is real. There's some draft spec, which draft specs, anybody can write a draft spec, right? So I don't. But, the fact that this is coming from Adam and Google team and stuff means it and literally works in Chrome Canary. So this is a lot further along than it seems to be. But yeah, there is, if this is the first time you've seen :: scroll button, you would be forgiven, this is brand new stuff. Scroll marker group is a totally different thing. It puts those little buttons below the carousel that are also have literal click functionality that you click and then it behaves like scroll button and it moves to that particular page of the scroller. But you don't have to say how many there are. You don't have to wire them up to do anything. It's like amazing how, what? We're getting that? That's crazy. And then this, we have inert in HTML, but we don't have an inert in CSS yet, right? So I think this, part of it is interactivity inert, meaning, let's say you have 15 slides, but only 3 of them are visible. That means all the ones that aren't visible should be inert because you don't want to be pressing the tab key and going through something that can't be seen, or at least that's a possible, you might want that. Now you can do that in CSS, but it's being applied through a scroll-driven animation timeline. That's how it knows it's not visible, is when the timeline is at certain points. That's some mind-blowing stuff. So yeah, I wouldn't expect to be learning this in even a super modern CSS course. I mean, this, sure. It wouldn't be appropriate. Yeah.
Wouldn't, no. But there's nothing wrong with people writing an article saying, this is how you use the new CSS carousel stuff. But if you've got a course called Complete CSS, that's like the whole thing is designed to be like, I'm going to make you a better front-end developer. Like by the end of this course, like the whole strap line of the course is you will be the same developer at the end of this course. And that's not, you will be the same developer because I'm going to teach you all the fancy new stuff. It's like, we're taking you from root to branch, like changing the way that you do everything. And then that in turn will make you write better CSS. And that, I think that's often forgotten with CSS, is there's a lot of soft skills required to be a good CSS developer. And I think that's what sort of sets it apart from the other languages, because of the nature of the way CSS works. Like, you've got to have some sort of soft skills about you to understand the system behind the browser, right? So
CSS wants to be a system for sure. I'm going to pitch you a course called... making you better, making you richer.
All right.
Is that okay? And like, it's really just about only using the hot stuff and then getting a new job before the technical debt blows up.
That's an idea.
So that's like the whole, it's kind of like 50-50, raising your profile and then blasting out of companies.
It's just a bit of agency in it, Dev.
Yes.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is my new consultancy is just basically hot drop new tech and leave.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the title of my book. Yeah. Hot drop new tech and leave.
Nice. My course will be how to just barely scrape by as a person and developer by Chris Cohen. I'll give you all the hottest tips for just riding that line.
Yeah, yeah.
Just flying every day. Movie. Yeah.
Like a wild animal. Yeah.
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 Something hard happened today. Just cry about it for a little bit and then figure it out.
Once two beers, fix it. Yeah. At the end of the day.
Turn your camera off, cry, and then just like, I don't know, eat a sandwich, eat your feelings. Yeah. Because you know what? Serotonin's made in the gut, and that's a great place to get happy.
Right.
So maybe I need to open an ebook arm to the publisher just to service these two ideas. Yeah. $9.99 ebook.
Yeah. Yeah. Call it mediocre press.
Slot press. Yeah.
Slot press. Oh, man. We could be blasting out books.
I know. What are we doing recording a podcast? Let's get on this. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we probably need to finish these books before over the weekend before this episode
goes before out, it goes but, live. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. All right. glad to be in business here. So we'll have to make it happen. Andy, I guess we'll have to cut it off here. But for people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
So the best place to follow me is on my website, so bell.bz, and that's got like links to everywhere where I actually am. I try and stay mainly on Blue Sky now, not because I'm like, oh, Blue Sky's better. I just can't be bothered with the multiple network thing. And then buy my course. I've got a coupon code for Shop Talk still going. That's like 20% off. So
nice.
Shop Talk all caps, then should be good to go. Let me know if that doesn't work. But yeah, that's about it, really. Just, read blogs and stuff and, make cool
ka-ching,
things.
Ka-ching. Mm-hmm. And subscribe to Piccalilli, best yellow in the business. And so thanks so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to shard it up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Mastodon, Blue Sky, or YouTube now. That's the thing we do. Join us in the Discord, patreon.com/shoptalkshow, where you can use the sad Andy emote.
Yeah. He's making you one of them.
Yeah. Premium tier sad Andy emote. So, all right. Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Fantastic. ShopTalkShow.com.